Thank you, Arctic Acoustic. I love the music. Welcome back to Hanging with History. This is Season 1. That miracle that happened. That one time. Episode 24. The Reformation in England. Henry VIII, Part 1. We're not having any guests this week. There is crosstalk and debate, but it's all in my mind. Like Augustine. And there'll be some coarse words in this episode, sorry. But I feel it's necessary. The Reformation in England sounds like a boring subject, but it's actually fascinating. Because it involves the nature of the living and the dead, how will we cope with the dead? The dead may die, but the themes do not. From Peter Hamilton to zombies to Game of Thrones, this is a live issue in our psyches. And there are characters like Henry VIII, Catherine of Aragon, Thomas Cromwell, Anne Boleyn, and Thomas Cranmer, Mary Tudor, better known as Bloody Mary, Reginald Poole, spelled Pole, and a virgin queen. Sex, pregnancy, human attraction, burnings, torture, beheadings, money, big money, greed, and fear are all involved. There's so much involved that there's a risk of losing the main story and all the interesting subthreads. 5 episodes at least. And our miracle filter is less of a guide than usual when approaching a subject like this. One with so much surface area. We're going to examine this from multiple perspectives. Pretty much all of it matters because of how it ended. So let me jump to the end before we go back to the beginning. The Church of England is separate from the Roman Church. The body of Christ, which some believe against Wycliffe, is the Church. The body is now fractured, according to some. The king, the monarch, is now the head of the Church. Doctrine, personnel, worship. The crown is supreme. The way is open for the divine right of kings idea, as if Britain were France or Spain. So though we end up with a Protestant country, all that needs to happen to open the wounds of sectarian divide is for there to be a Catholic monarch in the future. It all depends on the king now, a single point of failure. So in a future conflict between king and parliament, religion will be an added ingredient. Nitroglycerin to put next to the dynamite of ordinary power politics. If it goes off, nothing will be the same again. To begin, we will go back to Elizabeth's father. Since episode 15, we've been in the 16th century, but now we need to go back a little bit to the time of her father. And it started with a handsome, dynamic, charming, charismatic young man, a king in full, admired by all, a man in all perfection. Henry VIII. He was such an awesome guy that he got the best wife, a daughter of Ferdinand and Isabella of Spain. We call her Catherine of Aragon. Her apex-level family included the Holy Roman Emperor, Charles V, as her nephew. True, Catherine was 6 years older than Henry, but she came from a fertile family, which is what counted from the perspective of stability. But no, that's not the story. Henry was the second son. His older brother Arthur was supposed to be king. King Arthur, he would have been. Arthur got the amazing wife from Europe's most powerful family. He was a 15-year-old married to a 16-year-old Catherine. They were put in a castle in Shropshire to get busy doing what young royals are destined to do. Fuck. A lot. Make babies. Imagine 2 mid-teens, waited on hand and foot, living in all the comfort possible in the early 16th century, with one job. The young Crown Prince Arthur dies 5 months into this business. Henry's only 10 years old and suddenly becomes the Crown Prince, and furthermore is given his brother's bride to be his fiancée. This was done because Henry and Arthur's father, Henry VII, wanted a Habsburg alliance, and the Habsburgs wanted to shore themselves up against France, also protecting their very rich Flanders and Netherlands provinces. Arthur and Catherine's marriage was just transferred to Henry. But this is a Christian country and you can't go marrying your brother's wife. There's been a biblical prohibition against that since forever. The greatest power in Europe is influence, sometimes total control over the head of the church, the Pope. The Pope can get around anything. Catherine declares that the marriage was never consummated, so it was not actually a marriage, see? If the young royals don't fuck, they don't take the last necessary step to create a sanctified marriage. And see, she's not pregnant. The Pope provides a dispensation for Henry and Catherine to marry. It's all fine. The Pope's authority in these matters is absolute and final. When the Pope says something is fine, God goes, "Oh, I guess that's okay then." And yet, the more you say some authority is final, the more you actually begin to doubt it. Historically, the emperor was the final word, not the Bishop of Rome, the Pope. Popes were pretty terrible human beings at times. Heck, there were multiple popes at times. Could they all be infallible? Doesn't the Pope's authority come from a council of the church in history? Doesn't that mean the Pope's authority could be withdrawn by another council? Lots of people thought so, and argued so, within respectable sources inside the church. For 100 years before this, there was a clamor for a church council to be held to reform the church. These are the conciliarists I mentioned in previous episodes. Everyone talked about it. It was a hot topic for many decades. The popes won the argument there would not be a great council. But it makes the absolute, God-given authority thing kind of hollow-sounding. There's no biblical support for it, none at all. But apostolic succession, a blessing from Christ's hands, through his apostles' hands, from bishop to bishop through the ages. But Donatism. Apostolic succession was broken, plain and simple. It could only be symbolic, a thing of the mind. The physical chain of hand-to-hand transmission from Christ broke 1,000 years before. And wasn't Arthur bragging to his friends about boning Catherine? A great power, the Holy Roman Emperor, the Pope, and the King of England and Wales, could ignore things like that and set up the world any way they wanted. Henry and Catherine were just pawns. Henry was just 10 years old. Or so they believed. We don't know what they believed, but they behaved so. But as I've said before, every good thing we do, every solution we find, can be unsolved by those who come after us. They can screw it up. And that's just a real fact. Everyone involved except young Henry and Catherine died. And Henry became Henry VIII, and Catherine his queen. And she bore him a daughter. They named her Mary, and loved her very much. But they continued to age. Catherine grew thick around the middle. Henry did too, but he had plenty of mistresses and produced sons, bastards, even one Henry was certain enough of the parentage to acknowledge. Catherine produced no sons who lived. It was obviously her fault. At the time, most people thought that way. And others remembered she was first Arthur's wife. And a Hebrew scholar told Henry that the biblical prohibition against marrying your brother's wife, which is Leviticus 20:21, which reads, "If a man take his brother's wife, it is a severe defilement, and he has disgraced his brother. They shall be childless." The Hebrew scholar told Henry that in original Hebrew, it really meant they shall not have sons. "Oh, crap," Henry thought. "My wife and that dead trio, king, emperor, and pope, have cursed me. How do I get out of this?" And people said, "No, there's Deuteronomy 25:5, dude." It goes, "When brothers live together, and one of them dies without a son, the widow of the deceased shall not marry anyone outside the family. But her husband's brother shall come to her, marrying her and performing the duty of a brother-in-law." This is written as an exception to Leviticus 20:21, in the case where a dead brother has no sons. Arthur had no sons. "You're golden." "Okay," Henry said, but he was no dummy, not a dummy at all. Put your logic hat on here. There's a double condition in that Deuteronomy verse, an and condition. When brothers live together and one dies without a son. Henry and Arthur were not exactly living together. Then the exception is not satisfied in logic. "But that's okay," they all said. "The Pope's authority is absolute, and he said, regardless of all that, you're allowed to marry Catherine. The Pope saying so clears it with God, lifts the curse." And Henry is no dummy. Can a human man, off in Rome or Avignon, or they move around, don't they? Can this man influence God directly like that? Seems like a lot of scholars say no. The leading thinkers of our time, good Catholics, say it doesn't work that way. "Oh, don't listen to them," they say, "those eggheads, too book-learned for their own good. Everyone knows the Pope speaks and God just rearranges the world to fit his words. That sounds doubtful, Henry says. Careful, Henry. That's close to heresy, you know, they say. Yeah, it's true. People were burned for saying things like that. Well, there are all those people in Germany and Switzerland and the Netherlands really worked up about this. They seem convinced. They're even saying the Pope is the Antichrist. What if they're right? What if my father was wrong? Damn, Henry. You might have a problem.
I know.
Henry was not an intellectual exactly, but this kind of abstract reasoning was not at all beyond the ability of a very smart man. All this kind of thinking was basically laid out in writing on Henry's behalf, for real. And what else was going on? Henry VIII was a man in love, but not with Catherine. You remember what that feels like, how overwhelming, all-consuming it is when it first hits you. It hijacks your mind, heart, and soul. It's so delicious. There was a girl, a young woman. She was pretty, not to say beautiful. She wasn't blonde and busty the way everyone wanted in those days. She was quick and brave. She could rule a room, confident, funny. She makes me laugh. It feels good to be near her, to catch a whiff of her scent. The courtiers can't get the best of her. She's better than they. Raised in Paris, her sister is the mistress of the King of France. I should make her my mistress. My court would be so sophisticated, my life so happy. But she won't be my mistress, not with my curse. She has to be my wife or nothing. She's too good to degrade. I want to marry her, make her my wife. This alliance with Spain and the Empire is kind of a bust anyway. I want her. And I am king. That's what else was going on. And this is remarkable. Henry is king. He wants a woman, but she refuses to be his mistress. There are stories of that happening at the French court. When a woman refuses the king, a couple of guards merely hold her down. No problem. Kings get their way. It's good to be the king. But Henry of England did not do this. He took no for an answer. In 1530, he took no for an answer. What is going on here? Did Henry think he couldn't get away with a status hit from taking a woman? If that's true, it says a lot about England and the status of women. A lot. But maybe this is really a love story. A love strong enough to even tame a king who gets what he wants in life. Generally. And there's no way to know. Let your imagination run. Historians do it all the time. But Henry was getting that divorce. Nobody around Henry thought this was a good idea. Divorce was a no-no. It was not done. The subjects, the peasants, are revolting. Yuck. And they would not understand. Anne would be just a whore who stole the husband of a good woman who did nothing wrong. Catherine was doing her duty. She gave birth. Poor little boy died. You don't divorce in that situation. Your marriage isn't all you want. Join the club, man. Nobody around Henry thought this was a good idea. Despite everything they said, despite their attempts to get a divorce for him. You can tell because of the lame, pathetic things they did to get the divorce. They put pressure on Catherine to admit she consummated with Arthur. She wouldn't do that. Even though that would not overcome the Pope's sanction of the marriage. Of course she wouldn't do it. And then they wrote letters to the Pope. They sent embassies to the Pope. Hey, Pope baby, sign this divorce decree for our king, yeah? Catherine is by now the aunt, or aunt, of Charles V, Holy Roman Emperor, King of Spain, half of Italy, Austria, Hungary, the Low Countries. The riches of the Western Hemisphere were spilling out of his pockets, and actually had about a page full of other titles and lands. And Charles has physical control over the Pope at this time. His army sacked Rome in 1527. Why bother trying to get the Pope on their side when they needed Charles? The Pope said no. They kept trying. Each time the Pope said no. Obviously, because Charles said no. They just kept trying to make their arguments better. Dumb. His aunt. I mean, he may have had personal feelings. We know he did have personal feelings, but that's another story. Charles V is a really fascinating guy. He didn't die on the job like most emperors. He actually retired to live quietly, not clinging to the drug of power. He was like Pope Benedict in our own time. Few enough people are actually willing to give up the ring once they have it on their finger. But Charles did. He took off the ring. Anyway, I admired that, but he was still wearing the ring of power during all this, and feelings for his aunt aside, his cousin Mary Tudor stood to inherit the throne of England. He could marry her to his son with a papal dispensation. He could get that any time, and he already had what he wanted. Why risk that so some damned Protestant woman barely above a peasant could give Henry a son? The whole idea of it's nuts. But it was as if Henry's advisors didn't realize this. And I don't believe it. I've heard some of the arguments. I don't say all, because Tudor scholarship could and does fill entire libraries. I can't say I've read them all. I've read a few thousand pages only, but that means I'm not an expert on the subject. But I've read about Wolsey. By now, he's Archbishop of York and a cardinal, but his real accomplishment in my eyes was running the logistics for Henry's most successful invasion of France. That's an extremely difficult job, and he did it well. That got him the archbishop job in Henry's trust. Did you know that's what it takes to be an archbishop? Sometimes. Wolsey was smart, way beyond anything normal, and there he was wasting his time with the Pope. Of course he failed. Anne despised him, and thought he was doing this on purpose. Here I go against most Tudor scholarship that says Anne was unfair to Wolsey and got him fired. She spoke as if she blamed him for failing deliberately, and I think she was right. I can't prove it, but Anne was a really, really smart and sophisticated woman, high in every kind of intelligence, and she could see the lay of the land. You ever know someone like that? You can't fool them. That just makes them angry. Anne made Henry see that Wolsey failed, and to some extent it was because he took the wrong approach. Whether it was deliberate failure or not, it doesn't matter. At the highest levels, all that matters is success. You stop succeeding, out you go. That's how the world is. That was the way Henry played, even if he loved and admired his friend Wolsey, as very possibly he did. So Henry is stuck. The Pope will not give him the divorce. Henry is acting irrationally because of love. Henry sees all with unusual clarity because of love. Take your pick. Both work here. He has plenty of smart guys, and some less smart noble guys, working all the angles to get the Pope to change his mind. And along comes this lawyer, son of a brewer, son of a blacksmith, son of a violent-tempered commoner who's fined a dozen times for watering the beer he brews. His name is Cromwell. Not that Cromwell. Not Oliver Cromwell. We'll get to Oliver. This is Thomas Cromwell, from the same family, related to Oliver's grandfather. This Cromwell was an adventurer. He served in the French army in one of their disastrous campaigns in Italy against the Habsburgs. He stayed in Italy and became a merchant there, in Florence, during the time of the Medici, when Machiavelli was in office. He came home as a merchant, picked up law on the side, and worked for Wolsey when Wolsey was condemning and dissolving a couple dozen monasteries to establish a college in Oxford that would eventually become Christ's College, Oxford. He became intimately familiar with monasteries and dissolving them, expert level, possibly the expert in England at the time. He came to the attention of King Henry through his connection with Wolsey. Cromwell had the dangerous job of pleading Wolsey's case at court, not in a legal court, at the royal court, after Wolsey had been ousted from power. When Wolsey had a lot of high-ranking enemies who wanted him dead, 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 and his influence over Henry removed. I'm not talking about Anne here, I'm talking about some of the most powerful nobles in England, and I'll name Howard, Duke of Norfolk now. Cromwell had a delicate task, acting for Wolsey in those circumstances, and only massive integrity and loyalty allowed him to navigate those dangers successfully. He was also smarter and more emotionally balanced than everyone else around, and Henry noticed. Some sources say it was one conversation that caught Henry's ear. Others say it was over a period of time. But there was a logical way out of Henry's predicament. And yes, his predicament was his love life, his duty to produce a son. But let's change angles a little right here. Henry was a king and had lots of problems. You know the saying, mo' money, mo' problems. Well, that applies to kings too. One problem is the rot of the soul that sets in when a king has been in power a long time. Now, this is a history podcast, so why bring up the state of a man's soul? It matters when it comes to kings. They get their way. They never have to defer to anyone. They never have to treat anyone as an equal even. Decades of that, and of course it has an effect on you. Think of the people in your life. Decades of anything changes them. Henry didn't always get his way. Not in the North. Not in Ireland. Not in foreign policy. Not with the church and the Pope. Not with the emperor. So one problem or predicament is how to become even more powerful. How could he get his way more? How could he get more power? Usually, you go and invade France. Ah, you think I'm kidding. Nope. The other predicament is closely related. Money. Money, money, money. Kings need money, can never really seem to have enough. The demands on money seem to grow faster than the money grows. Governments nowadays do an amazing amount of deficit finance spending, but that was not so available back then. You could borrow, but at a huge 20 to 50% interest, so not a great solution. Forced loans from subjects, a little of that. Seizing the wealth of traders, a little of that. And there was the great custom from the wool trade we discussed in other episodes. There was royal lands, all kinds of fees deriving from the administration of justice, fines, the court of wards, regular taxation, tons of money really, but never enough, and invading France just seemed to suck up so much of it. He was still paying off the last invasion the way you might pay off a credit card binge. And to my younger listeners, don't do that, by the way. Try to pay them off each month. Money was also being used to heavily bribe people around the Pope, and many historians say they were trying to bribe the Pope also. Power and money. And power was not merely to get things done, not just to invade France. Power has a special rot of its own, like meth. You just want more once you've had that first taste. It can ruin your life. So consider Henry's predicaments. I'd rank order them as 1. Power. 2. Money. 3. Royal succession. 4. Love for Anne. Historians might differ in the order. You order them how you like. We don't know, we can't know. That's one thing people love arguing over. Stuff for which there is no answer. So, Cromwell. Cromwell, who knows all these languages, is smart and clever, he knows money, banking, and law, and monasteries, and he's also well-versed in all these religious issues. His integrity and sanity are also evident. He has no ties to potentially rivalrous landed power in England as a mere commoner. Cromwell gets things done. Lots of people can't get things done. They might be marvelous human beings whose souls you admire, but don't have that practical intelligence. But Cromwell, man, he gets things done. And he has this idea, a development of something Cranmer was working on originally. See if you can follow this. England used to be an empire, not merely a kingdom. Forkbeard, Canute, the legendary Arthur. And they didn't think Arthur was a legend back then. There was that whole time between when Joseph of Arimathea founded the church in England up to when the English church acknowledged the supremacy of Rome. That's like 700 years or so. I love the fact that all that episode 4 stuff keeps coming back. They had kind of forgotten England was an empire recently, but it used to be, and therefore it still was, and they just needed to call it an empire. Therefore, Henry was an emperor. You see, if the English church was sovereign enough to hand authority to Rome, then it was sovereign enough to take it back. This kind of logic plays a big part in history. We saw it in the council versus Pope dispute. We will see it again shortly when Mary I tries to deal with the consequences of Cromwell's idea. So Henry is an emperor. Big deal, you say. He's already a king. Well, an emperor's different. An emperor is above the church. In all the great councils of the past, the ones that settled what the Bible was, what the core doctrines were, what it meant to be a Christian, was settled by councils, the body of Christ, presided over by an emperor who approved decisions and settled disagreements. Emperors were different. They ruled the church under God. Does this seem flim-flammy? A little too much thin gruel? Wait, nobody eats gruel anymore. Cereal with too much milk? Vodka tonic without the vodka? Congee instead of the steamed rice? That's the idea. If I went round saying I was an emperor because some moistened bint had lobbed a scimitar at me, they'd put me away. It might sound thin, except that the King of England was almost an emperor this way already. A few episodes ago, we saw the king getting supremacy over the Pope when they conflicted already. because of the wars with France when the French owned the popes. So King of England plus a little more power. And that additional power could mean money. That additional power might mean he could make the church grant annulment. That additional power would win him his love. But how could he get this power? Well, that's consequential. The method would dictate the madness. Sorry for the cliffhanger, but we'll be back next week after conversations with Cammy.
Okay, we'll figure it out.
All right, Cammy, we just finished listening to episode 24 and the early life and problems of Henry VIII. What'd you think?
Well, in the beginning, you started in your introduction the way you described it. I kept thinking of the Game of Thrones.
Oh,
all the different action and twists and turns and sagas. And as you went on,
there's a lot of Tudor, Game of Thrones. War of the Roses type stuff.
Yeah. The authors of that book and series must have been well-versed in their
history. George R. R. Martin is, I guess he's still alive, very knowledgeable about that time period, that's for sure. I don't know about the later show writers, made some pretty weird choices in the last season or two.
Well, of course they did. It's entertainment. But still, I can see where they got some of their ideas for some of their stuff. So Henry VIII, he became the crown prince at age 10. I can't imagine a child being bestowed prestige at that age. It's hard for me to fathom.
There you are. You're growing up. You're becoming something. And then they pull you aside and say, oh, forget all that. You're going to be the king.
Though I guess he was young
enough. Congratulations. Just wait till your father dies.
He was young enough. He probably, you just grew up that way.
I think royals end up strange and behave in strange ways and less Christian, more evil ways. It's one of my pet theories. We'll get to it in episode 27.
Be careful. We still have royals in this world.
Not so much. We mostly have petty dictators and wannabe royals. I guess, we do have the Kims in North Korea.
An interesting person that you discussed in this episode is Thomas Cromwell. He sounds like a person with a lot of different background and things to learn about. Will you be talking about Thomas Cromwell more?
Oh, yeah, definitely. He's really important part of the most important part of Henry's reign, that's for sure. So he'll be there all the way to the end.
Good. I look forward to hearing more about him. Sounds like many people in Henry's reign ended up with that.
Yeah, keeping your head, that's a pretty tough thing. Not getting burned.
Your listing of Henry's problems, power, money, success, his love for Anne, and then his unusual way, I guess we're going to learn more about in solving those problems coming up.
And Cromwell really was the one who solved all the problems, but he solved them so neatly and then impossible to change afterwards. That it makes me wonder, makes lots of people speculate whether he did all this on purpose and planned it all out. I think maybe most historians will go like Paul Johnson and say, no, it was just a characteristic muddle. But then that lets in the weird alien stuff. Aliens intervened in English history to make the English Reformation work better than any place else, or the hand of God put their finger on the scales, and so could just be that looking at it from the perspective of the past, we see how everything happened and, we can see the neatness of the pattern that probably just wasn't apparent at the time. Although it could have been. And that's what the intriguing, fascinating thing is. Maybe it was. So Raoul Sunset's going to come along for the next episode and give us some insights about that.
Okay. Now I'm curious as to what's coming up next.
Okay. Thanks for coming on the program.
But how can I explain? How can I explain it to you? You'll understand less after I've explained it. All that I can hope to make you understand is only events, not what has happened. And people to whom nothing has ever happened cannot understand the unimportance of events.
That's T.S. Eliot from The Family Reunion. Thank you.